Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio.
For people who want to address climate change through their daily choices, a lot of the media headlines have pointed to avoiding meat as the biggest way to reduce the impact. But how animals are raised and managed by humans can make a real difference in beef's climate impact. And earlier this week, I had a really interesting conversation with Stephen O'Reilly, farmer at Goonview Farm, County Kilkenny, about regenerative agriculture, a system of farming where principles and practices focus on increasing biodiversity, enriching soils, improving watersheds, and enhancing ecosystem services, and the part it has to play in addressing climate change.
Okay, so I'm running a suckler farm, which basically is a cow-calf beef operation. I do a small amount of beef because I'm still growing my herd, but I breed cattle to sell to other breeders.
Oh, so that's what suckler is.
Yeah,
I've often wondered. I should have done ag science
yeah.
at school, but I didn't. So effectively, you're breeding them to then sell them as kind beef, of slightly older than calves or calves?
Oh, no, they'd be, they'd go into like 22, 24 months.
And then they're off to somebody else.
They're gone.
And that's what you're doing. You weren't born on this farm, were you?
No, we were. The Lord really blessed us in that front. It has to be said, the amount of things that had to line up was incredible. But my family on both sides, my father and his father, and my mother's father, were all in the truck business and the trucking industry. And I kind of went into that for a time, but I was always. Jumping in and out of managing farms and working on farms and that type of thing.
So you had an interest?
Oh, I did,
and
yeah.
So you'd done the ag science stuff and all that,
It was always a call for the land for me. And when I got trucking and I started doing that type of stuff, that type of work, I also was lucky enough, listening to my father, although I didn't agree with him, I did go in to do my trade in fitter welding as well, so... it certainly has helped me with the farm, but it was always kind of a longing to get back to the land. But of course, when you're not born into it, it's extremely hard, if nearly impossible, to
get into.
Especially in Ireland.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, a good lady that we know, we started renting from, and we were running horses on it, and we basically, through years and years of building up a friendship, she gifted us her farm. Incredibly great lady, a lady of God, truly. And she also taught us so much and helped us bring us to the Lord. That's where it started, really, for us. And it is a stunning farm. And we run a herd of Belted Galloway cattle, which are a Scottish breed.
Yeah.
Probably the oldest breed in the UK, oldest breed in the UK.
Wow.
And it's a very hardy animal, which suits the terrain and what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve.
So Galloway, that's like the borders kind of with England.
Southwest. So they're an incredibly hardy animal, an animal that's really suited to this type of system, but you can certainly do it with traditional stock, but not so much with your big continentals from Europe.
So you're going to have to explain to me what regenerative farming actually is in like, and you're explaining it to me like I'm stupid, because I am.
Regenerative farming is really your main focus in regenerative farming is the soil, biology of the soil,
right?
Keeping your soils healthy, building topsoil, and how you do that is through mimicking nature. You're working within nature's borders. So you're not coming in with intensive artificial fertilizers, and you're not relying on annual seed crops to get you by. You're really trying to work within the boundaries of what nature on your farm holistically is allowing you to do.
So in trying to keep the soil healthy,
mm-hmm.
so you're not using piles and piles of chemicals.
Yeah.
What are you doing? How do you get, is that like using fresh manure, or what is it? How do you
In a way it is. It's your fertilizer comes out the back end of your cow.
Yeah.
And
sure.
It's how you manage your land ultimately that will help out your soil. So if you're going to complement your soil and how you build your soil, it's how you manage your stock on the land and how you give the time you give your land to heal after being grazed.
Yeah.
So your land needs time to rest. And basically what we're trying to do on the farm and what regenerative agriculture is trying, the principle of it is that you try to mimic the nature's wild herds. So out in the African plains and in North America and what have you, you'd have maybe 500,000 wildebeest, zebra, gazelles, all coming in together in one massive mob.
And they move. And then they move when they're done.
And they're bunched up, but they're bunched up not because they want to hang around together. They're bunched up for safety because they are followed by predators, really ferocious predators.
Yeah.
And as they're moving, as they're bunched up, the more they're bunched up, the bigger the herd, the safer the individual. Mm. And by that going on, then the dunging and urinating is taking place from them grazing.
Yeah, so there's that intense dunging, as you say.
Yeah, and that encourages them to keep moving.
So it's really interesting. You're saying the land has a chance to rest when they move away. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's kind of what they used to do in the medieval times. They would leave a fallow...
Not even that long. Like we're talking 100 years ago.
Really?
You know, like what regenerative farming isn't some type of catchy phrase. It is truly the way farming used to be.
It was done for tens of thousands of years.
Yeah. And
that's the way.
Yeah, exactly. And when that mob is moving on forward, like if we go back to the wild herds that we're trying to mimic with our domestic herds, they push into heavy grassland, which is generally permanent grassland, as in perennial type grassland.
Yeah.
They have deep roots that go way down into the soils.
Okay.
And that deep rooting is what helps to capture the carbon after sequestration takes place.
Oh,
it's what gets it down there to bank it way down.
Even in grass?
Oh, yeah. That grass is way more efficient than trees that sequester carbon.
Really?
Yeah, way more.
Wow.
Yeah, you'll find that I think it's 98% of the best, most fertile soils in the world are in permanent grasslands, not forests.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Most of us will be around water this summer, especially with the good weather we are scheduled for this weekend. Some of us will be swimming, fishing, out on a boat or kayaking. During the week, I spoke to John Leach from Water Safety Ireland, who gave me invaluable advice on staying safe around water during the summer months.
Some of the local authorities, not all, are putting out their lifeguards early as a result. And we're putting out this evening and tomorrow evening because people obviously have to work and want to go for a dip. The water is just beautiful at the moment, as you know, and it's nice and warm. It's about 16 degrees in most of the bathing areas.
Is it really? Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah. No, it is. It really is nice. And one of the reasons for that is because we've no winter.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
I do. Yeah.
Sub-zero.
It never really froze. Yeah,
no,
I get you.
Exactly. So we never got very, very good. So the water temperature is nice and warm, very pleasant. So some of the words of warning I would give is that obviously, if you're swimming in a place where there's no lifeguards, which is what the majority of people, probably of your listeners, will be doing, then just swim within your depth and stay within your depth unless you're swimming literally 12 months of the year, you know, 365. Yeah. And there are lots of people who do that, and some of your listeners will be doing that because it's brilliant for both your mental and your physical health. And so we advise you, if you are going swimming, and maybe it's your first swim of the season in open water, is just swim within your depth, stay within your depth. And if you do, then get into difficulty because most people, they tend to plunge into cold water, sometimes out of a hot car, which of course is a terribly dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
And that brings on cold shock. And cold shock is the largest contributing factor to all drownings in this country.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's what brings in that uncontrollable breathing and your heart rate goes up and your blood pressure goes up. And that brings on panic, and unfortunately panic then can bring on the inhalation of water, and then, you know, the rest can end in tragedy. All the research we've done during people's swimming accidents during heat waves is they jumped in out of their depth. Virtually 95% of the people who drown would have literally jumped in to cold water out of their depth, sometimes straight out of a hot car, out of the office, God, let's go and cool off, bang, hit cold water, and aren't able to cope with it.
My
and then unfortunately, wade into the cold water, and in what we refer to as traditional bathing areas, that's areas where you've got a yellow box and you've got a red ring buoy. Make sure there's one of those around, and obviously then if somebody does get into trouble, one of the others can just grab the ring buoy and throw it out to the person in distress, and then there's no issue, there's no problem. It's just a normal rescue, using your voice and then reaching out to them with the ring buoy, or throwing it, I should say, and then just taking the person back in. And so that's advice. The other advice is be careful. As a result of the overfishing in our waters, in fact, all around the world, we have more jellyfish than ever than in our lifetime.
Really? I've actually encountered I've encountered some of this myself, and I remember my father telling me, like, back, you know, many, many years ago, kind of on the swim out to Dorky Island, it was well known for jellyfish. And yet I was aware there was more jellyfish in recent times, and you're saying it's to do with overfishing.
Yeah, jellyfish, there's quite a few studies done on it, and I've obviously read the studies, And basically, they're known as the cockroaches of the sea. Wow. So they're around before most fish ever were around. So at one stage, you know, the oceans were full of jellyfish. And then as the millennia went through, you had the fish developed and all the rest. So, but basically what happens is when you overfish, you take a fish out of the biodiversity of the ocean, then there's a vacuum left. And what happens?
Jellyfish fill it.
Jellyfish move in and they fill it.
Yeah.
And gosh. so that's why we're seeing so many. I mean, I was out in Galway Bay myself on Tuesday, and I saw quite a few of them out there already. And you know, years ago, it was always the lion's mane jellyfish was always associated with the south coast and the east coast, particularly, and the north coast, obviously, as well, especially the northeast coast. And that's changing, and now we're just seeing them on the west coast every year.
And jellyfish are dangerous?
The lion's mane jellyfish is particularly dangerous. You know, it's the one that can have, basically the top of the jellyfish can end up being up to 2 meters, and it's not uncommon to see 1.5 meter jellyfish. They're brown and they're mailed,
and they've
got very long tentacles, and it's the tentacles which break off and get into the skin, and they can be incredibly painful. And unfortunately, some people, a bit like some people are allergic to peanuts, but some people are allergic to the jellyfish thing.
Yeah.
And they get anaphylactic shock, and they've got to get them straight into A&E at that stage.
Sure. So John, tell us, what are the statistics on water-related fatalities in Ireland each year?
On average, a 10-year average is 127 people drown in around our island nation, and through all our rivers, lakes, canals, reservoirs, and you name it, drains and bog holes and all kinds of awful, terrible places where people have drowned over the years.
127 per year, is it?
Yeah, 127 on average. Now, in 2017 was 109, and by the end of this month, we hope to have our figures out. And we're at the moment, it's looking like we're going to be actually very close to 100. And last time we did 109 drownings was in 1952, I think it was. Yeah. And whilst if we get below 100, we're going back to almost pre-war figures. So, I mean, your listeners, the nation out there, are doing a good job. There's more water safety awareness than ever.
Yeah.
We are doing the better things. We're wearing life jackets every time we go out now, and that's just crucial, this lovely weather. Don't take it off to take the suntan. You know, come ashore for your suntan. Make sure you're wearing your buoyancy aid or your life jacket when you're out here on the lake or the river, the Shannon.
And I was interested too, John, that actually 62% of drownings, just what you were describing, 62% of drownings occur inland. And that really hits me, that on a day, really hot day, people start dreaming of water and they'll go to the nearest body of water, whether it's suitable or not for swimming, and possibly go there and get themselves into trouble.
Unfortunately, you're right, and as you know, we had a double drowning tragedy last year in a quarry, and we would say to your listeners, and make sure your listeners, the parents, they are, talk to their children, don't go near quarries, they're absolutely lethal.
Definitely.
And yet there's a fascination about them with young children, with teenagers particularly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, the quarries are incredibly dangerous because very easy to get into, but incredibly dangerous, difficult to get out of, and that's unfortunately that's why they're so dangerous.
The Best of the Morning Show.
For this week's prayer coach, I caught up with the Reverend Gary McDowell, minister at Greystones Presbyterian Church in County Wicklow. He was just back from holidays in the south of France in the beautiful medieval walled city of Carcassonne. The fortress of the city is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and we had a great conversation linking this in with the theme, God is our fortress.
We went to this city, I'm sure many of your listeners will have been there, called Carcassonne.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of it?
Of course I have, yeah.
It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Yeah,
beautiful. A city, a wall city, the best maintained wall city in Europe.
Wow.
And if you go to France, it is the second most visited place.
Nice.
The Eiffel Tower is the first.
Really?
Carcassonne is the second. Yeah.
I've seen the photographs and it looks magnificent. Was it good?
It was fantastic. Well, I initially saw it, we were going down the motorway and I saw it at a distance and it just looked stunning. And it was actually Walt Disney.
Yeah.
Saw that city and he was inspired from that city to create Cinderella's Castle. So when you see Cinderella's Castle, those lovely turrets and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's city. Only this is the real thing.
Yeah, wow.
So we went, this magnificent fortress that's been around. Well, the Romans really kind of established it, recognizing its strategic importance 2,000 years ago.
Sure.
But lots of different folk have come and gone. A lot of battles have been fought. A lot of building has been done. But yeah, it's a city of two walls. So if you get over the first wall, there's a big ditch. There's another wall. Yeah. A drawbridge with a couple of those big doors, whatever you call them.
Yeah.
So it was. They believed it whenever it was finished. It was impregnable. It was. You just could not get in. It was just completely sound, well protected, fortified, and it was great just to walk around and see it and feel it. They got a super cathedral inside. I mean, it's a proper city inside. It's just one huge tourist place these days.
You have me sold. I'm going.
Yeah, you and I'll go.
That's right. It's fabulous.
As soon as the show finishes, we'll get a plane over.
That's what I feel.
Ryanair.
Like I feel like doing that now. I feel like driving down to the southeast corner of Ireland. Getting on a boat and just driving directly there myself.
So, you know,
it's interesting you're talking about the fortress because that's what we're talking about today.
Yeah. So, well, that's just what it reminded me of. This is a fortress. And when you think the Bible over and over and over again talks about God being our fortress. And there in Psalm 18, you know, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God is my rock in whom I take refuge. Or Psalm 46, you know, a mighty fortress is our God. But just that imagery that God is our protector. You know, the people inside Carcassonne could have got in there, pulled up the drawbridge. They were safe no matter what the enemy was doing outside. They weren't going to get in. And God's like that. And just made me think how amazing that is. Our God is a fortress who protects us.
Absolutely.
But not only in that imagery, but all so many places you get that imagery of God being a protector. You know, even Psalm 23, where David says, "The Lord is my shepherd." The shepherd protected the sheep. You know, he fought lions and bears to protect the sheep.
Yeah.
Or that lovely verse where Jesus comes out of the temple in Jerusalem, but he looks at the crowd and he said, "So many times I would have loved to have taken you under my wing like a mother hen brings her chicks, you know."
It's so
but you weren't willing.
Yeah, it was so interesting to hear you say that because I was just thinking, you know, we're kind of emerging from a kind of a national spasm, I suppose you could say, of fear, of fright.
Yeah.
When things went downhill in the late noughties.
Sure.
And the thing that people mostly felt was unprotected. They felt like they were on their own. Yeah. They felt there was nobody there, they were going to go bankrupt, or they didn't know what they could do. They lost their jobs or whatever it may happen to be. It's like a national feeling of being unprotected and having been in some way abandoned. It's such a powerful image, isn't it, when you come in with God as a fortress. Yeah.
Well, the world can be a really scary place. And, you know, from the moment you're born, when you're trying to learn to walk, it could be an intimidating place. You go to that first day of school or wherever it might be, or we just look at the world and you watch the news or read the papers and just see a scary world. You think, where are we going? What's going to happen next? Because our world in recent times has been completely turned upside down. And that can be shaky. But it's always been like that. And that's why the psalmist says, "You're my rock. He is the rock that does not move. Everything else moves. But God doesn't move." That's why he says, "Stand on me, stand on me." And when I was just thinking about that, I was thinking, you know, in what way does God protect us, or our heart, does he? Because it would be lovely if we had this force field around us where nothing bad ever happened to us, you know. But God's protection isn't like that. It's not like the force field where nothing bad, because we live in a fallen world and we are a fallen people. But in the midst of the scary times, when we don't quite know what's going on, or the times when our health's not good, or we worry about our job, or getting a job, or our family, or, you know, our pension, or there's a billion things to worry about, but it's in the real life situations that he does protect us. You know, sometimes it's immediate, like I was thinking about Jesus in the boat with the disciples. They were scared to death when the storm came. You know, he stood up and said, "Peace, be still," and that had an immediate effect. But other times, God's protection is simply he gives you courage and strength and a calmness in the midst of turmoil. So maybe someone's listening to this today and they feel their life is in turmoil, but God's protection is for his spirit to come along and say, you know, "I am with you. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. You're mine. And you'll be fine because I've got a hold on you." And the greatest protection, of course, one of the greatest things in the Bible is that nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ, you know, because of that. Doesn't matter what comes along, we can never be separated from him. And whatever the world does, whatever Satan tries to mess with our heads, which he often does, God's spirit wants to be the one to protect us, just to trust him. Jesus said to his disciples before he left the earth, you know, you trust God, you believe in God, trust me, you know. And we can trust him because, as David found, as many of the writers of the Old Testament and the New Testament find, God is our fortress, a rock, a deliverer. We can find refuge in him.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
Sister Moira Keane from the Sisters of Mercy has recently been awarded the Irish in Britain's Individual Award for her work as a chaplaincy prison outreach volunteer. She's an incredible lady, and she spoke to me this week about joining the Sisters of Mercy.
I left home 60 years ago on the 4th of August this year.
Wow, that's big. Congratulations to you. So, and have you been in the UK? You joined the Sisters of Mercy and went to the UK at the same time?
No, I came to the UK to join the Sisters of Mercy. But there's a lot of training in becoming a sister as well.
Of course.
And because I was so young, I had to wait an extra time. So there's, you're an aspirant, and then you're a postulant, then you're a white novice, and then you're make your temporary profession, and then you're finally professed. It takes 7 years.
I'm just wondering about the young woman leaving Galway and landing in London and the culture shock that must have been back in 1910.
No, there was no culture shock because there was no, once you went into the convent in those days, you didn't get out for a long time.
Right, okay.
You know, there were 70 of us in the house in London.
My goodness.
30 in the novitiate side and 40 on the other side.
Wow.
And there was a lot of silence in those days. And, you know, the training was pretty tough.
Yeah.
Tough.
I'd say the life of a sister has probably changed very dramatically in those 60 years, has it?
It has changed dramatically. But, you know, sometimes, especially with the older sisters here, I wished we were back in those days because we were so used to being told what to do.
Okay.
And you did what you were told. Whereas nowadays, you really have to take responsibility for yourself and your actions. In the early days, it was your mother's fault. We don't get away with that anymore.
That's for sure.
So
you have recently been awarded, as I was saying to the listeners here, the Irish in Britain Individual Volunteer Award for your work as chaplaincy prison outreach volunteer. But you didn't put yourself forward for it. How did it come about?
I was in Romania for 2 weeks. At the time, there's a wonderful team at the Irish Council for Prisoners Overseas, and they actually did that behind my back because they know that if I knew they were going to do it, I wouldn't allow it.
Yeah.
Every sister in the country, Ireland, England, or wherever, does voluntary work.
Yes.
But what I suppose was a great advantage to at the Irish Centre in London was that I actually had the experience of being a chaplain, of being in the Northeast for 12 years full time. So there isn't much I don't know about prison, and I still have contacts with the chaplains, and I was an obvious candidate to be invited to be a volunteer, for which I'm very grateful, because it's a privilege, really, to be sitting at the end of the phone helping prisoners that are desperately lonely or desperately stuck or have lost touch with family. And we're also in touch with the families.
Yeah.
So if mommy doesn't know where Johnny is, in general, we can find out for her.
Yeah. I'd imagine it's challenging but very rewarding, is it?
It's challenging. It was very rewarding. But you have to have the right mindset, because success isn't a word you ever use.
Sure.
The fact Johnny is not in prison today is a good thing.
Yeah.
And they keep in touch with us after they've been in the prison. But it's a terrible shock to one's system to go to court and maybe convince yourself that you're innocent or that the crime does not merit sentence. And you might be standing there in front of the judge with no money, you have your phone taken off you, and you lose your independence.
Very shocking. Yeah, I know
very,
what you mean. You
very frightening and very shocking. The first one is very frightening.
Yeah, you walk through the door as a free person and very quickly that radically changes and you leave, you know, and you've been stripped of all of what you own and you're in a prison van and that's you for the next year, 10 years, 15 years, whatever. Yeah, it's...
So,
the work you're currently doing at the moment, you're in Accrington and Castington prisons, I believe.
No, I've retired.
Oh, you're retired, okay.
And I'm now in Clacton-on-Sea in Essex, a pastoral carer to the elderly.
Wow. That's
exactly.
That's a real change for you.
I can tell you, Ronan, it's harder work than being in the prison.
Is it really? Wow.
And the banter and the language, it's all different.
I
miss it.
I can well imagine.
And of course, they were so good to me as a chaplain. I was the only woman for one thing, and I was a sister. They trust the sisters so much. It's unreal.
Absolutely.
And they warned, we have a sister, Moira. She'll do anything for you, but don't mess with her.
I love that. That's brilliant.
And it worked. And it worked.
It worked,
but the organization that invited me to come and work with them now in my days off, my spare time, is the most wonderful organization. I just don't know how they keep going, but they need volunteers. And of course, there isn't a lot of admiration or funding for prison or prisoners. The victims, yes, and they're well looked after. There's a lot of organizations that work for them, but it's, and especially if people have been at the receiving end of men's or women's bad behavior. So to be fundraising or to be, you know, admirable in these looking after prisoners, it's not appreciated. And I can understand that.
Yeah.
The Best of the Morning Show.
It can be a particularly lonely experience to go through the grief of losing a baby through miscarriage or stillbirth, and it's something that our culture has not always been the best at acknowledging. There is something uniquely difficult about this type of grief, and during the week I spoke to Pat Story, Church of Ireland Bishop of Meath and Kildare, about the introduction of a service that has been compiled for acknowledging this loss.
I would say that I've lost three babies, three miscarriages before I had my living children, and I would say the main challenge is that it's invisible. You may not even have told people you're pregnant if it's a very early miscarriage. And so there's a distinct lack of support. You know, when somebody dies in your life, everybody queues up to offer condolences. But when it's a miscarriage, there isn't really such an acknowledgement of loss. And so I think it can be quite a lonesome trek.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've because you haven't shared it with anybody, because nobody knew about it, they don't know necessarily that you're even in grief. And yet you
are. and even when people do know, I don't think they know what to say.
Sure.
Now, we're better at it now. You know, I was sort of, it was the mid-80s and late-80s when I had miscarriages, but I think it's a bit better now. But I think then it was kind of, you know, pull yourself together, it's been a week.
Yeah,
and of course it takes a lot longer than that.
I know, yeah, and years later, you're still dealing with the consequences of it, you know.
Yeah,
you never quite get over the loss. You know, and is it, so in a way you think it's easier, do you think it's easier to speak about it now, or what?
Well, I do think it is, in that, well, like a lot of things, I suppose we talk more about what happens to us, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think people react very differently. I wouldn't want to generalise, because some women, you know, some women do get back up and go to work in a couple of days and forget about it. You know, that's the reality for some women.
Sure.
And other women, you know, there's a sadness for a very long time. You know, quite often, 30 years on, I still remember the dates that the baby would have been due. And,
exactly.
You know, it's not the grief that it was, of course it's not. But there's still kind of a poignancy about that.
The church has always been very good at helping people through bereavement, through funeral liturgy. But I think you've spotted a gap in the market here.
Yeah, I think so. I think until now, although there have been funeral services, there's been absolutely no acknowledgement of miscarriage at any stage of pregnancy, you know, even very late in pregnancy,
yeah,
and stillbirth. Neonatal death, you know, if a child has lived for maybe a few days, there would be a funeral service.
Yeah.
But there's been very little liturgical acknowledgement, or, in fact, theological acknowledgement.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that something has actually happened.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about a stillbirth, which, and I mean, it's all of it is shocking, and all of it is a horror, and, you know, we have had some experience of it too ourselves, but the idea that a fully formed child almost at term is born,
yes,
and that isn't acknowledged, there's something really kind of off about that, I've always felt, you know.
Yeah, I think so, and even, you know, I think from the very first moment, if the baby is wanted, from the very first moment a woman knows she's pregnant, she's carrying a baby.
Yeah, of course.
And so whether it's at 8 weeks, it is much worse at 18 weeks or at 28 weeks, it really is, or a stillbirth, I think that's worse again. But, you know, still from early days, a woman, when she finds out she's pregnant, feels like she's expecting a baby. So then she feels that she has lost a baby, and not just, you know, although the baby maybe isn't fully formed till 12 weeks.
Yeah.
And there's maybe not a heartbeat till 6 or 8 weeks. Do you know, as soon as you find out, you're expecting a baby.
For sure, for sure. So tell us about the new liturgy endorsed at the recent Church of Ireland Synod.
Yep, sure. I mean, I wasn't involved in the forming of it. I was just asked to speak about it in Synod, so I didn't take part in producing it. But I suppose there are aspects of a funeral service in it. But it's specific, the readings and the prayers would be specifically geared towards pregnancy. So Psalm 139, you know, when I knit you together in your mother's womb, is one of the readings. Luke 18, where Jesus welcomes children to him and says, the kingdom of God is for such as these. And then actually one of the really precise moments that I think is really poignant is the naming of the baby.
Yeah.
You know, my Absolutely. Miscarriages were 12, 14 weeks.
Yeah.
I didn't even know a gender.
Yeah.
But, you know, that ability to maybe name a baby, I think, just gives the baby and the mum and the dad some dignity.
Absolutely.
When we talk about the mothers, but actually the fathers suffer too.
Sure.
You know, they've lost a baby too.
Of course.
And I think just that sort of naming, and then further on in the service, there's a symbolic act. So, you know, you can maybe bring up, maybe you've bought something for the baby that you could bring up to the church, to the holy table. And it's all just an acknowledgement of loss. That's what it is. It's not pretending that it's losing a child who's born and been with you for 12 years, because that's not the same thing. It's, you know, whilst there's no hierarchy of loss, I think we all acknowledge that once we have living children, that's a very different ballgame.
And yet, I absolutely accept what you're saying. I was actually present at one time. It was actually a family tree mass, and the priest, I remember the priest saying to the woman, "Did you ever give this child a name?" You know,
and
it was like it never had been done, and something happened in the room with the naming of the child. It was
definitely. I think so. There's
you know?
Just that very clear. For as long as this child has lived.
Yeah, absolutely. It's powerful.
It is extremely poignant.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what do you think the hope is that this change will achieve in the wider church?
Well, I think for women and again and men, it's a loss acknowledged, and that's the main thing. I wouldn't say necessarily it's closure, because grief goes on and on and on, although it does help. You know, there's something about our liturgies of funerals that help people navigate grief, and I think this will help people navigate grief. It's not closure, but it's a point in the loss where we can say, you know, we can acknowledge the loss and say, look, something has happened here, which previously has been invisible.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Looking for a sunny city escape? Well, Joe Supple, our travel doctor, is just back from Lisbon, and I caught up with him and how he got on. He gave me great tips for how to get there, getting around the city, the food, and he also took a day trip out to the coastal village of Cascais, which is a traditional and charming Portuguese fishing town just 30 minutes outside the city of Lisbon.
Most people would sort of think the Algarve,
Summerstone,
and bits and pieces, and I had friends who'd been to Lisbon before.
Yeah.
So I was with the Portuguese tourist board a couple of weeks ago at an event, and they said, why don't you come and check it out? And I had a little free slot, so I went to actually find out about Lisbon and see what it was all about.
So what did you make of Lisbon itself?
I absolutely adore the place, and I want to go back there ASAP. It's so beautiful, and there's so much to do. I did 72 hours there, which is quite short, but it just worked out perfect. For people who haven't been there before, there's a couple of airlines who do fly there, but I flew with TAP Air Portugal, which used to be their national carrier.
I remember, yeah.
Which was privatised there a couple of years ago.
I didn't know that.
They've increased their full fleet, and they also have the wide-body aircraft. And just interesting for people, because people often say to me, what's the cheapest way to get to, you know, to Australia, to Brazil, or to go connections-wise? And there's so many different ports, but Lisbon is actually one of the biggest. It's huge there. They have huge onward connections. So if you're thinking about maybe going to Brazil, it's one of the most popular airlines to fly with.
Of course, yeah, because the Portuguese connection. So actually, it's a hub.
It's very much a hub, yeah. It's a really, really state-of-the-art.
And it's funny because I know most people, Irish people, they bypass Lisbon altogether and just go straight down to the Algarve. But this is, it's a very different kind of a holiday. And of course, it's on the Atlantic coast, or is it?
It is, yeah. And I mean, and the great thing, as I said about it, is your connection's there. But I mean, and also, you know, the short flight time is great. Two hours, 20 minutes, you're there.
Yeah, absolutely. And no change in time.
No change in time. Everything's the same, which is really, really good. Yeah. So yeah, the website there is flytap.com. I flew over with them and they put me up in business class, which was very nice.
Very nice. Absolutely.
And you're looked after very well. Of course, you get the lounge and all the bits. And it's a really, really good service. And they fly twice daily to Lisbon. So again, if you're flying to Lisbon or maybe looking at onward connections, there's really good deals.
And that's ex-Dublin. Direct
to Lisbon.
Getting around, bus, car, what kind of? I mean, it's a major city, right?
It's a major city, and there's a thing called the Lisbo card, which is really good. And basically, you can buy it for 24, 48, 72, whatever you want. I had it for the 72 hours, and I was there. It's a really good service. And again, from the airport, the connections are unbelievable on the subway. So basically, you have your card, you charge it, and then you have your 72 hours to use it. But it also gets you into like museums, no queuing,
wow,
places to go.
That's a brilliant idea. So it's called the Lisbo card.
Lisbo card, yeah.
Brilliant.
Now, the tourist board put me up in a place called Oriente, which is about 6 minutes by subway to this area. And it was a beautiful area. And I'm really far out, but actually, you know, when you get on the subway, it's just so handy and so convenient.
And 6 minutes, like, you can't really argue with that.
You're on, off, done with the hotel, whatever. Yeah. And there, as I said, a really, really nice area of that area. But it actually was, the Eurovision was held there last year, wasn't it?
Last year.
It was in that area. So it's become a really, really popular hub where people, you know, new apartments coming
up. They probably developed it up a bit, yeah.
All that type of thing going on. Again, I wanted to experience the subway thing, and you know, I always sort of compare it to the London Underground because it's so easy to use.
Right.
And I found this exactly the same way. The connections were really good. No looking and waiting, which line do I go on? And within sort of 30, 35 minutes, you're right in the centre of Lisbon. And of course, it's steeped with culture there. The most beautiful buildings to go and see.
That's what I remember. As I said, I went in to do a gig and I'm going through the streets going, ooh, this looks nice.
Yeah.
I got to come back. Haven't, but you know, it's very nice 20 years later.
It's definitely,
you know?
even for a city break or something, it's definitely worth it. But again, when you get there, you know, you've got the beautiful subways there. So it sort of reminded me a little bit of San Francisco,
old-fashioned
subways. And you're literally driving past the doors of people who live there, and they wait till the subway and they come out of their front door, and it's great for people watching.
That's wild.
It's really, really good.
And you know the way we always go, in terms of price, would it be like Spain and Italy, or is it more like Britain, or is it more like here, in terms of cost?
Cost-wise, be more, sort of on the Spain sort of level.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get in sort of centre parts, there is expensive restaurants to go to, you know, my biggest tip is always don't go near the, you know, it's like somebody coming to Dublin and going to Temple Bar, why would you go to Temple Bar?
Yeah.
Walk out, see the traditional little restaurants, or even the concierge is always great in a hotel. Ask them, where do you eat? You know what I mean? Because they'll tell you the best place.
Absolutely. And what did you make of the Portuguese food?
Loved it. Absolutely adored
the food.
Of course, their famous little custard tarts things is the big thing over there.
Oh, they're evil.
A couple of those as well. And again, when you come outside with your card, you can use it there. I did the subway, and then you do an overground, which takes about 45 minutes to a place called Qashqai, which is absolutely stunning. It's like a sort of a beach waterfront type place, and there's the most amazing buildings and stuff there.
Did you say 45 minutes?
About 45 minutes on the overtrain when you get off the subway.
Brilliant.
And it's a really good service, and you've got great little restaurants there.
So what you're doing is you're getting the best of city break, but you can also do the seaside thing as well.
You can absolutely do the seaside thing. Now again, going out there, prices will be a lot more cheaper to rent maybe an apartment in the short term or hotels.
Yeah,
so you're not staying in the centre. Like, you know, in the centre of Lisbon, they have the fancy Four Seasons hotels, the Ritz, all those big brands. You're going to be paying huge money for that. And again, we looked at a couple of restaurants and we're like, wow, that's really expensive, but you are right in the centre of the city.
So would you say there might be something to be argued to say stay Qashqai and then take trips into the city then? Would that be an option?
Would be most certainly an option. Or even where I stayed in Oriente, I really loved staying there. So first I was thinking, God, I'm really far out, but actually it suited me perfectly because there's great little bars and little fish restaurants around the
corner. Going on.
You get a beer, you get a main course, you know, for like €8-9.
Wow.
So it's very reasonable
as well. Can't argue with that,
But it's definitely a great, and it's also a great walking city. I clocked up the miles on my old 50 over there.
Good man. Yeah, you got the old steps up, did you?
Get the steps up when you're over there. So it's a fantastic walking city. And again, when you're getting that train, you can also go to a place called Sintra, which is absolutely beautiful as well. Again, it's a coastal town. There's really little popular places. But I would say, you know, I did the 72 hours. Yes, it was a great experience, but I definitely would go back and experience more.
You know, you guys who have to do it in that kind of squashed up time, it's wonderful, but on the other hand, you really have to jam it in, don't you? And you're kind of seeing places and you're looking at things rather than actually being able to really, really enjoy them. So fair play to you for bringing back all that information. It's really good.
The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.